Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Better late than never, I hope. Sorry about the slow start, but we're here. What about La Mancha and Alka-Seltzer, Waggy? we'll get all these playback issues sorted out now that I'm home. Sorry about that. The third switch has been thrown. This is the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. You can, of course, find the horn in a wide variety of other locations, places like Dar.fm, Streama.com, Roku devices for your smartphone. We recommend iTunes or iTunes or Stitcher. Their apps are reliable and good. They're listed there. Podcast address is, of course, at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program, Head On The Podcast. And you can get the podcast at iTunes, too. I'm streaming, but yeah, it's all going out, so we'll hope things improve here momentarily. Well, diddly spit, silence. Time out. Throw the 12th switch, Bob. Okay, so it's recording now, which is even better. And what else? Yeah, everything seems to be working. A big thank you to all of you for putting up with the technical glitches that tend to happen when we're on the road. Although John and I did a bunch of work with the mix desk that I take with me, and I think we knocked wood. No, that's not really wood. That's some sort of composition. That's wood. We seem to have that worked out now, so it should be behaving much better in the future. Like I said, it's Thursday, the second day of May. Yesterday was 20th wedding anniversary for Agnes and me. Naturally, we spent it apart. So I don't know, I'm going to try to find something nice to do for her for the week. Because, you know, really, wedding anniversaries are always a little bit lopsided. There's one side that feels like the other side has to put up with a whole lot more. And I think I'm that person in this 20-year-old marriage. So I need to do something nice for her. Yeah, I did miss National Law Day, May Day. But I'm here now. And you know what? When the program starts this way, it is frustrating to no end because you've got your head in one place with places you want to go, things you want to do, And then the 17th switch doesn't work. But we'll be okay. We'll get into the meat of the program, and things will work out nicely, I have no doubt. Where to begin? Note coming in from Kevin. Oh, well, thank you, Kevin. Best I've sounded live in quite some time. That's nice to know. Might have something to do with some of the equipment that's been installed. Maybe it's better equipment. Thanks, Kevin. Much appreciated. Dr. John noting, excellent news from Rhode Island. Props to Lincoln Chafee, who's been on the right side of this for years, and it cost him. But Rhode Island, in fact, yes, has become the 10th state to make marriage equality a matter of law. To make, you know, the 14th Amendment, and thereby the rest of the Constitution and all of the laws of the United States real for a lot of people for whom none of it had. So, yeah, that's happy news to start the program. Now, of course, we missed prayer meeting Wednesday. Well, y'all didn't miss it. I did. I was on the road. No prayer meeting Wednesday yesterday, so there's a story. There's a prayer meeting Wednesday kind of story in the stack, even though this is thorn in the side Thursday, but I think it also qualifies as a thorn in the side. Of course, there are other stories out there. I'm sure you are horrified, as was I. You know, the story that broke on Tuesday. The 5-year-old little boy down in Kentucky Stan, of course, the Commonwealth, who accidentally, the story says, shot and killed his 2-year-old sister. Now, we have these stories, it seems, all the time, and they are never any the less heartbreaking for whether it's the 13th one or the 19th one, but this one has an angle to it. This one has a sickening angle, an even more horrifying angle to it. I can remember back when ours were little ones. I remember 1 year when she was really tiny, Margie wanted baby tumbles. And Ferg has never gotten the 4-wheeler. There were various and sundry things at Christmas time. We would bust our humps to get them. And maybe it's just because of the way we run this family or who we don't run with that I am unacquainted with apparently an American tradition of giving real live, honest to Jesus, no kidding, rifle guns to 5-year-olds. Because see, the 5-year-old, usually when one of these stories comes along where the 5-year-old kills someone, a couple of weeks ago it was in Tennessee when the child shot an adult woman, usually those stories involve the firearm being left out and about and belonging to someone else. And by someone else, I mean an adult. This story, however, has an angle that just... The 5-year-old who killed his 2-year-old sister did so with his own rifle. You know, it's not unusual in the gun-crazy, particularly rural parts of America, for grandpa to say, I got him a 410 shotgun. On the day his grandson is born, because it's kind of sexist, we are. I got him a 410 shotgun. We're going to go out and we're going to learn how to use it and handle it proper like when he's old enough. Find. As four. In the case of this particular story, the firearm that the five-year-old used to kill his year-old sister. You know, I've said that a couple of times now, and it's still not okay. On levels beyond the fact that it wouldn't be okay anyway. Happened in Cumberland County, Kentucky. A single shot from a .22 caliber rifle killed little two-year-old Caroline Starks. That was the finding of Cumberland County Coroner Gary L. White. He was interviewed by the Los Angeles Times via phone. He said, most everybody in town, notice most everybody, that's a southernism. He's not saying that there's somebody there in town who's actually happy about it. Most everybody in southern means everybody. Most everybody in town is pretty devastated by this. Pretty devastated. That's another point. Yeah. We like our modifiers. Most everybody in town is pretty devastated by this. Nobody wants to take anybody's guns away, but you got to keep them out of harm's way for the kids. It's a safety issue. Because, see, the .22 was just propped in a corner, and the parents, against whom no charges will be filed, because the NRA would be right there to defend their right to keep a loaded... Oh, Jesus. The parents said they just didn't know. They didn't know there was a bullet in the gun. The parents said that about the gun that had been given as a gift to the five-year-old boy. Because, see, that's the really, oh, Jesus part of this story. There is a company out there, Keystone Sporting Arms. I'm assuming they're from Pennsylvania, Stan. You know, that part of Pennsylvania that's between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and is, in fact, Alabama. Keystone Sporting Arms has a line of firearms called Cricket. My first rifle. And they've got a cute little logo of a little green cricket, you know, Jiminy Cricket, only he's armed to the teeth. I guess this cricket doesn't say, let your conscience be your guide. He says, you gotta lead him a little bit. Cricket, my first rifle. Proudly made in the USA. Now, this isn't any Chinese People's Red Army rifle for a five-year-old. This is an American rifle for a five-year-old, by Jeebus. My first rifle. Marketed, as the Cricket website says, especially for youth shooters. Well, sadly, the five-year-old was a youth shooter. The youth he shot was his two-year-old baby sister. And you know what? For the little girls, they come in pink. Really, pink rifles, .22s. They come in pink, you know, for the little girls. Because, you know, everything a little girl has is supposed to be pink and blue for boys. And they've got a show off gallery page with a lot of little cheerins holding their guns and their targets and wearing their orange vests. Keystone Sporting Arms, the owner of Cricket My First Rifle Company, describes their firearms as being, and this is a quote, ideally sized for children 4 to 10 years old. I take issue with that. I don't think there is a firearm in the world that is ideal in any way, shape, form, or fashion for a child 4 years old. I don't think there are any, I don't think there are any firecrackers ideally suited to a child who's 4 years old. I don't think there are any, what's out next from Keystone? Booster seats so your kid can drive a car. Strap these little leg extenders onto them and they'll be able to reach the pedals when they're three. Sadly, and I will say sadly, I have not found any follow-up news stories in which the president and CEO of Cricket, My First Rifle, was found in a barn having hanged himself. Oh, that's mean of me, isn't it? Yes, it is. But what's more mean, me saying that, hypothetically, or whoever that is, in reality, anybody want to do the research? Anybody want to find out which hedge fund owns Keystone Sporting Arms? Any bets out there? No, really. What's meaner? Me saying that the head of that company should probably go and relieve the planet of his presence pretty lickety split? Or that person actually sitting at a meeting saying, "What? We're going to have a line of rifles for four-year-olds? My God, we're going to make the money with that. What we got to do is get the guns into these little children's hands earlier, or else they might grow up and realize that they don't have to live a life of paranoid fear and, It turns out that last month, April is the cruelest month, remember? Yeah, it turns out that last month, four people were shot by human beings who only recently figured out how the potty works. Four. Shot. Killed. The children. Because you know that Barack Obama, he's going to take our guns away. And when he takes our guns away, how's we ever going to teach our four-year-olds how to protect freedom, Wolverines? Good God. Isn't this a little bit out of hand? Does a time ever come when we say enough? Now, meanwhile, Cumberland County Coroner Gary L. White apparently took it upon himself to defend the fine folks at Keystone Shooting Arms and their Cricket line of children's firearms. He said, "That little Cricket rifle is a single-shot rifle, and it has a child safety. This was just a tragic accident." And, of course, yes, in the news story from the Los Angeles Times is the obligatory paragraph about how it is legal in Kentucky to give a child a rifle as a gift, nor is it unusual for children to have rifles often passed down from their parents or from their grandparents. Or maybe it's old multi-great-grandpappy's musket what he done used to try to hold off the bluebellies during the War of Northern Aggression. It had a child safety.
Well, it's meant to be used by a child. That means the child's safety can be operated by the child.
And I sit and I think about the torrential, tsunami-like waves of grief that must flow over and through this family. How do you grow up? I'm not asking this out of a lack of sympathy. I'm asking this out of an abundance of it. How do you help a five-year-old grow up and say, well, son, you know, the rest of your life is going to be a hell of a lot better. We're just going to start fresh now. And just kind of forget about how, we know you didn't mean to, but just forget about how you blew away baby sissy. How do you do that? That's not a rhetorical question. Anybody got any answers? How do you do that? How does this child not grow up a complete wreck? I mean, we had a president once for way too damn long, 8 years as a matter of fact, who, when he was a little boy, had a baby sister named Robin. And his baby sister got leukemia. And it was hell on the whole family. And when the baby sister died, Mommy and Daddy turned him over to the nanny and went out and played a round of golf, Mommy and Daddy did, having just put their 2 or 3 year old in the dirt. And I submit to you that George W. Bush never got over that. Yeah, I don't think you're too far off base, Marty. He said, I guess in this case the kids are white. Otherwise, a black 5-year-old would have to be tried as an adult with the prosecutor seeking the death penalty. Yeah, you just know this is kind of a white people problem, isn't it? Or maybe I'm wrong, but this is the only culture I've grown up in, so to speak. Do black families, Asian families, Latino Hispanic families, do they give firearms to 4-year-olds? I mean, apart from the marketing department of Cricket, My First Rifle, who thinks it's a good idea to give a real live, no kidding, rifle gun? Yeah, it's just a .22. Who thinks it's a good idea to give that to a baby? Because when you come right down to it, although the scale is somewhat different, it's on roughly the same level as giving a baby the nuclear football or a hand grenade. Throw the ball, baby. Throw the ball. Oh, no, don't take the pin out. Oh, you took the pin out. So clever. Children are clever. And they'll figure out things you never wanted them to figure out. I'll never forget one day we were visiting with my dad. It was after my mother had died. We were down in Alabama. And Ferg got away. And, you know, and when you got a bunch of kids, wait, where's fill in kid's name? And we found Ferg, and the outsides of his mouth were kind of baby blue. And we didn't know whether he had eaten a packet of sweetener that had turned him blue, or had just eaten one of Grandfather's heart medicine pills. Because Grandfather wasn't used to having little kids running around the house. Out of an abundance of precaution, away we went to the ER, where he had vomiting induced. And you know, what a day that was. It turned out he'd eaten the sweetener. We were fortunate. Accidents do happen. Grandfathers do forget to put away their medicine when the little people are coming. But explain this to me, please. How? Because, I mean, I've owned firearms. I've gotten rid of all of them but one. How does the mind work that gets a child-sized 22 for a child first? Okay, we'll just blow right past them because there are people in this country who think that's a good idea. But most of the people who think that's a good idea also think that gun safety is really important. You know, because that's what the NRA harps on. They got their little Eddie Beagle program or whatever it is. And if you see a gun... But how do you forget to check the weapon at the end of the day and make sure that it is absolutely not loaded? How do you not check it four or five times to the point that it becomes something verging on obsessive compulsive behavior? I don't know. Jim with a note says, remember, candy cigarettes? Same planned learning behavior. Oh, yes, and bubblegum cigars, too. Or toy machine guns. Yeah. But, you know, we dare not think about making a law saying that it should be illegal to market firearms, real firearms, real 22 caliber single shot firearms to children. Because then we get, that's the camel's nose under the slippery slope. And the next thing you know, you ain't got your freedoms no more. And they're rounding you up and sending you to the Obama FEMA re-education camps where they'll teach you to hate guns and love Kenyan socialism. Yeah. So we have that. That's Kentucky. Let's move a state southward. Tennessee. And Coffee County Commissioner Barry West. There really is a Coffee County, most likely named after General John Coffee, who was an associate, I believe, of Andrew Jackson, wound up with a lot of land in the North Alabama, Southern Tennessee area. Wound up with, that's a short way of saying, helped steal it from the native peoples who were living on it. It turns out that Barry West has a sense of humor. Because he posted a picture on his Facebook page of a man wearing a cowboy hat. Now, we've just talked about, we touched briefly on the idea of gun safety. And even if you take an NRA class, and this much I will say for them, the classes out there, once you get past the ideology and everything, of the simple mechanics of handling a firearm, aren't bad. You know what the first rule is? I think the first rule. Always assume a firearm is loaded. Rule two, based upon rule one, never point a firearm at anybody under any circumstance unless you intend to do them grievous and perhaps mortal harm. So the photograph that was on Coffee County Commissioner Barry West's Facebook page is a photograph staring straight into the business end of a double-barreled shotgun. The person holding it, who is apparently not Barry West, but just some guy wearing a straw cowboy hat with some outdoorsy-looking gear, and he's got his sun-leathered, otherwise pink flesh showing his arms, and he's holding that shotgun, and he's staring down betwixt the barrels with one eye closed. And Barry West captioned it, "How to wink at a Muslim." You know, because the fella with looking down the barrel of the shotgun's got one eye closed. How to wink at a Muslim. Gall dang it, that's just funny. No, it isn't. So somebody up there in the lamestream media over to the Tennessean newspaper, which once upon a time was a damn fine newspaper, and is now run by the Gannett Company. Gannett? Gannett? Whatever. The Tennessean called him up to get his comments on his picture, and he says, they wanted to know how it got up there. He said, "No, I did not Twitter this. No, I did not create this picture. Yes, I shared it. So why am I being singled out?" Well, Einstein, let's look back to your answer. You shared it. How to wink at a Muslim. You know, I was just funning. He did take it down. Not necessarily because he thought it was wrong, but because he was getting tired of getting lamestream media questions. Because the lamestream media kept asking questions. The Tullahoma, Tennessee News called. Again, wanting to know just exactly what it was that motivated Coffee County Commissioner Barry West, who don't look nothing like the feller in the photograph, I can tell you. He said he found it on the Facebook and he posted it to his own page because he thought it was humorous. And so the Tullahoma News then asks him, "Well, you prejudiced against Muslims? When did..." Oh, Jesus. To which he answered, "I'm prejudiced against anyone who's trying to tear down this country. Muslims, Mexicans, anybody." You'll notice he didn't say white folks. "If you come into this country illegally or harm us or take away our benefits, I'm against it." Hold on a minute. Take away our benefits? What? Oh, he's been listening to the Beckerhead and probably Alex Jones. And all of that palaver about how the Mexicans is getting all our getting all our welfare. Yeah. I mean, I just showed it to somebody else. If you're going to harm this country, I'm not in favor of you. I don't appreciate people to tear down. I don't appreciate people trying to tear down this country. Ain't got nothing against no Muslims per se. I got a $100 bill, says this guy never took Latin. I ain't got nothing against no Muslims per se, but if you're trying to tear down this country, find somewhere else to go. You know, you'd probably be hard-pressed to get him to understand this. But, you know, somebody really should tell Barry West that there are people trying to tear down this country. Really and for true. They're called Republicans. Really. We talked a little bit about things like Head Start on Friday. Let's talk a little bit about Meals on Wheels. That's the modest little program that tries to make sure that senior citizens don't just starve to death. Let's see. Meals on Wheels of Contra Costa County, California is going to be cutting its program by about 13 to 15%. Now, at present, Contra Costa County, California delivers 1,500 meals to older folks who like to eat food. Well, that 1,500 number is going to be cut to 1,300. So that's 200 people per day who don't get to eat. And as of yesterday, out there in Contra Costa County, California, they have frozen enrollment for the Meals on Wheels program, with the exception of those who are deemed to be in the most critical need, who have no other means of getting a daily meal. Interestingly, no one contacted John Hagee for this story so that he could yell, "Starve!" That's one Meals on Wheels program. They are... The problems are not limited to Contra Costa County, California. How's about Lamar County, Texas? Beginning yesterday, Lamar County Human Resources Council is no longer receiving funding for Meals on Wheels. They're going to run their entire plan as is through May the 31st. Then on June 1st, the cuts come in. We like to call it austerity. Belt tightening, right? There in Lamar County, they've gone scrambling for grants and donations. Good luck with all that. Among other things, these senior outreach programs don't just bring meals to people, they also bring seniors to senior centers where they can have interaction
and not live lives of desperate, quiet isolation. Well, that's gone. In what may turn out to be the understatement of the evening, Tantetta Moore, executive director of Lamar County Human Resources Council, said, without it, elderly clients will go without food. This will impact their health. It will impact their quality of life. I'd say it will probably impact their ability to be considered alive. Think Progress surveyed these folks. Broome County, New York runs a Meals on Wheels program. They're looking at about $10,000 to $12,000 gone from what was already a relatively meager budget. They were bringing food. And see, when we say that, oh, they're bringing food to 390 seniors every day, well, that's not all that need it. Those systems have already been set up so that there are already people getting cut off because this is, of course, a Christian nation. Starve! They serve 390 seniors every day in Broome County, New York. They're anticipating that they'll be getting rid of their personal care services, things that, well, for instance, they send people into the homes of elderly people to help them with laundry and housekeeping. The money they were paying for that, they say they're going to put into trying to make up the shortfall in the food budget. This isn't robbing Peter to pay Paul. This is robbing Peter, kicking him to the curb, and then stomping on him for a while. And then giving Paul a tax cut. If we assume that Paul is a member of the 1%. They don't know exactly what's going to happen to him in Rapid City, South Dakota, but it ain't going to be good. Rapid City, South Dakota is going to lose something like $25,000 out of their Meals on Wheels program. Even before this, and remember, this is all based on a mathematical error, right? Even before this happened, and by this, I mean the whole idea behind austerity. You've read the story. It's a couple of weeks old. Somebody didn't carry the six. Or the one. Or the two. Not the one. They didn't carry the one. Even before all this started, the Rapid City, South Dakota agency had closed its doors in two rural communities. Because it was deemed there weren't enough participants to warrant the cost. Yeah, I guess that whole, if you've done it under the least of these, you've done it also under me thing is pretty much, that's passé now, isn't it? Marcia Murray is the director of the program, she said, of closing the low participation centers. It's really too bad because they're in remote areas and they're more food insecure. And it looks like more of those remote areas will be closed as a result of sequestration. Maybe now that the delays have been cut back, we could get some Republican politicians to maybe fly out to Rapid City or Broome County, New York, or Lamar County, Texas, or Contra Costa County, California, and watch some old folks starve! Well, where's the fun in that? They never contributed to their political campaigns anyway. F them, right? Things aren't any sunnier at the Memphis, Tennessee Metropolitan Interfaith Association. They were getting money to get food to senior citizens. Why we can't do this as a function of government instead of giving the money to religious agencies, it's beyond me. But never mind. The interfaith group is getting their budget cut too. Right now, they serve 1,800 meals every weekday. They're looking to trim 5% from their budget in belt tightening. James Seacat is the director in Memphis, and he said, we really can't tighten our belts anymore because there's nothing left to cut, and the belt buckle's already touching our backbones. Well, I put those words in his mouth, but that's the essence of it. There's just not a lot of fat, really, he said. It's really a quadruple whammy for us. With government funding being down, expenses including gas and food costs are up. The population who need our services, of course, is growing, and private donations are either flat or, in some instances, declining. But the need is huge, Think Progress notes. Tennessee is ranked fifth in the nation, fifth for senior hunger. Which brings us back to Coffee County Councilman Barry West, who, of course, lives in Tennessee, and says, I'm prejudiced against anyone who's trying to tear down this country, Muslims, Mexicans, anybody. If you come into this country illegally or harm us or take away benefits, I'm against it. I'm guessing, however, that Second Amendment guaranteeing freedom loving probably NRA member Barry West has not gotten on the phone to the likes of Marsha Blackburn and said, I don't like anybody who takes away our benefits, sister. Get back to work. I don't reckon he's done that, do you? No, the only threat he can see to this country is that somebody who wears different headgear is here. Bear in mind, of course, that in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, they tried to build a little mosque. And you can't swing a run over possum in Tennessee without hitting a church. One mosque ain't going to do it no harm. They sued in court over it, and when that didn't work, somebody tried to burn it to the ground. Now I don't have much regard for any religion of the organized variety. You know that. But I do kind of have to note that it's pretty serious business inside Islam that one not leave the widows and orphans and old folks to starve. It's one of those things that, having the ability to alleviate suffering and watching widows and orphans and old folks starve is one of those things that gets Allah right wrought. But Barry West doesn't know that. Barry West doesn't know, for instance, that there are Islamic organizations all across this country who feed people who need food every day. No, all he knows is that he knows how to wink at a Muslim. Right down the barrel of my, right down the center of my trusty double-barreled shotgun. That's right. That's how you wink at one of them.
Meanwhile, Zach Mojadin lives in Tullahoma, Tennessee. And he said, in cases like this, I'd say he was born too late to hate the Japanese. If he were born earlier, he would say the same thing about the Japanese. True. And you don't want to hear the words he probably uses to describe persons of color when he thinks that nobody who would object to those words are anywhere nearby. Now, here's the fun part of the Barry West story. Do you think for one instant, do you think for one teeny tiny moment that he isn't going to get reelected? You think that might probably get him some votes in Coffee County, Tennessee? I'm telling you, it will. Drost Kokoye is an American Muslim Advisory Council board member in Tennessee. And said, this may just be a picture to him, but for us it is very threatening. Muslims in Coffee County should not feel safe to walk outside their homes. Well, with all due respect to Ms. Kokoye, Muslims anywhere just about in this entire United States should not feel safe to walk outside their homes. Mr. Mojadin, that I referenced a couple of minutes ago, she said, that gun was pointed at me and my family. We know that these lead to discrimination and hate crimes in the Muslim community, and we are very wary of that. I am a second-generation American. My children are third generation. We don't see ourselves as anything but American. An Episcopalian interfaith activist named Daniel Tutt called for West to apologize. I got 5-3 odds against the apology. Don't you? Welcome to America. Sergi, by the way, has written in from Texas. He says, the answer to the question, do black, Asian, and other non-white families give guns to kids is that that young, is actually not completely yes, nor is it no. I know about this topic well, actually, as a resident of an inner city. There are some families in which one or both of the baby's parents, usually the father, is a real screwed-up-in-the-head ghetto type, and guns get involved in the life of the kid. These come in three flavors. In the first, they generally don't give the kid the gun. It's actually using the gun as a prop to take a photo of the kid for the Internet, to impress their screwed-up-in-the-head friends and relatives. When it comes to the second scenario, generally, the screwed-up parent gives a gun to a kid at about 10, and it's usually for the purpose of recruiting their kid to help defend the interests of the parent's street gang. The third scenario simply involves the parents being careless with guns, generally either kept for self-defense or for gang violence, and their kids get to the guns, play with them, and end up shooting someone or some people by accident. So honestly, Bob, it can't be said that gun-related stupidity is only a rural thing. Lots of morons running around our inner cities and suburbs as well. True enough. And I don't disagree. I don't know. Maybe. But like I said, this is the culture I know. Stupid me. You know what I did when Ferg was born? put a baseball glove in his crib with him. When Margaret was born, I took her into my arms, and the first thing I ever said to her was, "I'm your daddy, and I love you." Then I said, "And all liability is based upon fault." She was going to be my little lawyer. And with Doodle, I knew she was going to be our last, and I just held her and cried. She was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I guess I'm just not a freedom-loving American, because I was not over... the first thing that came to my mind was not the need to put a godforsaken death instrument in their bed with them. It was an act of faith, Marty. To the extent that I engage in those, I put a left-handed glove, you know, a glove for a left-handed player, in his crib, and he turned out to be a lefty. Yeah, I wanted a left-handed pitcher. Still working on that. Sandra is with us at the now that I've filibustered the hour away. Are you there, Sandra?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
Listen, the only reason why I called is, well, hello, first of all. Hope
Hi.
All is well. But I am calling because of this Plan B situation. Okay, here's the scenario. So, you know, a 14-year-old, you know, fairly enlightened kid, a 14-year-old girl, okay, you know, she has sex, oh, my God, with her 13, 14, or 15-year-old boyfriend. We'll keep that age range so we don't get into some other issues.
Right, sure.
Okay, you know, I mean, she's enlightened for a little 14-year-old. She knows about safe sex. But, oh, my goodness, a little accident happens. And this enlightened 14-year-old is like, shit, I don't want to get pregnant. Let me go and get a Plan B pill. Oops, can't do it.
Right, and even...
Okay, and... The thing is, if she was 15, she has to have some ID. What 15-year-old has government-issue ID, Bob?
I guess it, well, maybe, what, a learner's permit?
Okay, no. What 16-year-old? What 17-year-old?
Sure. No,
what
I get your 18-year-old? Point.
18-year-old?
Yeah.
And why does a woman, because, I mean, last time I looked, you could roll up anywhere and get a goddamn condom. You could be 10 or 8. And get that motherfucker if you wanted to.
Sure.
Now, there's no reason. Science has said it's as safe as buying aspirin. Why in the world, and if the court told the administration it needs to be universally accessible.
Well, see, that's the furniture kicking moment for me, Sandra, is the court said it. And... If the Obama administration Justice Department and Eric Holder have the ability to make judgment calls, you know, witness the way they responded to DOMA, for instance. Made the right decision there, not going to defend DOMA. But on this, they're going to draw a line in the sand?
Well, I mean, I just think it's just, you know, just there's an element of tyranny involved with this executive branch, but that's another conversation. But my problem is the sort of sickness that this country has with women and their fucking body. Now, a teenage girl, you got 10-year-olds who are have periods now. Now, I'm not advocating that everything be accessible to a 10-year-old, but you know,
well, no,
let's
I mean
face it, that's the reality.
Well,
now,
can we have that little comparison and contrast moment here for just a second, Sandra? I mean, I think there's real relevance to this as compared to, you know, what I started the program with. We've got 22 caliber rifles for 5-year-olds, and a 15-year-old young woman can't get this pill?
Well, yeah, I mean, no, but it's an outrage because you can walk in and pay the prohibitive price of, I think it's like $60 this shit. It's well overpriced. You pay this money and you take it, follow directions and take it, wouldn't you rather your daughter be able to take care of this situation right away as opposed to an abortion or carrying a baby to term? I mean, I'm just sort of flabbergasted at this administration, especially when just the other week he was talking about, you know, I'm the president, going to walk hand in hand with you to protect your reproductive rights, you know, a speech he gave to Planned Parenthood.
Right.
I mean, I guess we're all real stupid, I guess, because you must be out of your goddamn mind, because what you're doing right here is putting up one barrier after another, along with if you're some sort of undocumented person and you need it, how you gonna get it? I mean, it goes on and on and on, and it's all about, oh, well, you shouldn't be fucking. I know it sounds crude, but
the only thing I would say, Sandra, is that this is another one of those operating from a position of fear moments for the administration, because this is safe as aspirin. There is no reason, except for the fact that they're afraid of the right wing, and they're afraid of the Republicans, and they're afraid of their own shadow, and frankly, there's not a lot of fundraising to be done from 15-year-old girls.
Oh no, exactly. No, but it's just the kind of it's the kind of positioning that, you know, we progressives need to take note of and see how quickly we're sold down the river in a minute, because this is real shit right here. This is real lives that can be made a lot better if teenagers who are having sex, let's just say this again, they are having sex. So you think of that as your parent, you're like, okay, yeah, I'm not happy about it, but I sure the hell want the young women in my life to be able to get something that's going to take care of a situation that makes a difference between them feeling a bit queasy and going back to school, or them being fucking pregnant? Are you crazy?
No. It's...
I'm sorry. I'm just like, apoplectic over this shit, because the reality is too weird. You have a technology that has been created that can prevent pregnancy if taken within a 72-hour window. And you're telling me that reproductive age people, women, can't have it, and you have dumbass pharmacists saying to men, you can't have it? You know that? That's what goes on?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember the story.
Yeah, and they say, oh, no, you're not allowed to buy it. Say what?
Yeah. I remember the excuse, Sandra? He might be a child rapist and give it to a little girl.
Yeah, well, no, but I thought that the girl's body can take care of that kind of stuff. I mean, which one is it?
Round and round the chicken coop, you know?
Yeah, it's just, the thing is, it's really disturbing because, you know, just what's wrong with this country? Because this Plan B has been, I mean, this is going on near a decade and a half of trying to get this shit made available. Do you realize this?
Yes, I do.
God. And now it's still not available. Because the Obama administration said, oh, this is a compromise. Are you sick of their compromises yet?
It's a compromise in the embarrassing thing that you wish you hadn't been caught doing meaning of compromise. Well, I agree with that 100%.
And I feel ill when anytime he like is throwing up his daughters in this discussion too, because you know what?
Yeah, you caught the tattoo remarks or the piercings remarks.
Yeah, that was equally icky. Okay, but it's icky because we know they'd be at getting that Plan B as fast as you could run away.
Well, sure,
and
you know what? Mommy and daddy, wealthy mommy and daddy, anybody. We'll do that instead, because it beats the hell out of an abortion.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I'm not making a judgment about abortion. No, I'm saying that
it's the same.
Cost and simplicity and safety.
Non-invasive,
right.
It is on and on and on, and that is the key. These people who want to control women cannot abide having a simple way of dealing with unprotected sex. They can't deal with it. And I guess the Obama administration can't either.
Well, I guess that leads to a little moment of speculation, because, I mean, can you imagine Michelle being okay with this?
Well, the thing that's even more disturbing is this compromise that they're coming out, but you also know that they're going to challenge, this is on top, they're going to challenge the decision.
Yeah, that's the part that's not driving me crazy, but I find this extremely disingenuous, Sandra. Did you see the administration's excuse for why they feel they have to appeal?
Hit me.
They said they feel like the judge overstepped his authority because he didn't allow them more time for internal review.
Oh, no, there is no. All this just smacks of them catering to the crazy right-wing people, and they're just weak ass because this ain't affecting none of them. Once again, it's not affecting none of them. They'll have access to whatever they need in their risk-free existence. It's all the rest of us who have to be subjected to this madness. I mean, I think this shit's been available in England for everybody since it came on the damn market, I think in the 90s.
France? England? Yeah. Places we generally refer to as civilization.
No, but those girls somehow are different, Bob, than our teenage girls. I'm confused. I need to be clarified on that.
Well, I think they probably are. They're considerably better educated, for starters.
Well,
but that's,
I think the sort of punitive, if you have sex, you have to be punished by being pregnant.
Well, consider that nasty-ass woman that they forced children to watch in two high schools in Kanawha County a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
And the young woman who stood up to her, she stood there in front of them and said, if you have sex out of marriage, you will pay.
Yeah, and then this principal's trying to, like, thought he was going to destroy her future. That's the thing that was just over the top. It's like, wait, if what you're doing is so righteous and right, why are you freaking out? That would be my first question to that idiot. I thought what you're doing is so righteous. What's the problem? You know, these people are disgusting. And these young people who step up now and then, you know, I am so impressed because the deck is stacked, you know? Shit.
Oh, there's really deep, deep background stuff with this because, whether it's acknowledging that teenagers have sex or trying to inhibit females in any way that they possibly can, ultimately this is that ugly, ugly puritanical streak that runs all the way to the bone in some segments of American culture that says, and it's not just American culture. I mean, it's European culture. It's the culture of the church that says that sex is dirty and wrong and it's sinful and therefore it must be punished.
And women have to bear the brunt of the punishment, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't want to hear it either. It's a 3,500 year old problem.
Well, no, but I don't want to hear the great black father, saying that we need to I have to have permission, because he has daughters. Somehow that gives him. I don't even know what the hell he's talking about when he's making comments like that. It's like, well, no, maybe your daughters can talk to you about everything, but the predation visited on kids in this society, give me an effing break. You need all the access to help and solutions as you can get as a young person in society, because there is no support. This isn't Spain, where they love their kids.
No.
And I'm not saying that we don't love our kids here, but I'd be goddamn, there is no support in this country if your family is fucked up, okay?
Oh, no. I mean, I think you and I had a conversation, about a year ago, where I mentioned that great line from the Anna Karenina about all happy families are happy in the same way, but unhappy families are all differently unhappy. If you're part of the unhappy family group in this country, cancel Christmas. They ain't nothing for you here. They ain't no help. Don't get old.
Mm.
Because they're
it's, and so when I, and then so when we get a situation where everything is laid out. You know, technology meets progressive public policy. You're like, yippee. But then we get this Democrat who's going to throw a spanner in it. Please, 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 please. I am so over it. It makes me feel sick. You know, I mean, I'm like, what the hell? Just because it's not based in reality, you know? I mean, yes, if you're a reasonable adult and you can influence a young person, by all means, try to drive them into the right direction. Great. More power to you. But this sort of pretending that a parental figure is there for every child? Give me a break.
No, no. I think there's an ascent. And I don't know how it gets to be that way. We're talking about a man who was raised by his grandparents for all intents and purposes.
It's just magical thinking. It's magical thinking, and you know, whatever situation he has, great, but. Not being able to project outside of that is, you know, lack of empathy, it's narcissistic. You know, there's a whole host of signifiers for that madness. And I'm kind of like, I mean, it's shocking.
It is. But what part of this country isn't shocking anymore?
I know. I just, you know, that just sort of, you know, pissed me off. Beyond belief, because the judge told them to stop, and they're saying, no, we won't. We're going to do it like this. Completely sidestepping the court order.
What does that mean? We need more than 30 days for more internal review.
No, you don't. We've had endless, a mountain of scientific evidence to say that this is a safe means for, contraception. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, yeah, you just got a big amen note in from Beth in Texas. She said, Sandra nailed him. Beth said, for some good while now, I've been calling him president as the father of two daughters, Obama, because after the second time I heard him say it, I've noticed that he drags that phrase into virtually every presidential pronouncement on the subject of women's reproductive health. As for Mama Michelle, I have yet to hear her make a single pro-choice pronouncement in public. If someone can cite one for me, I will be most relieved to stand corrected.
She's a single parent? Remember that?
Oh.
Well, no, listen. But, you know, I mean, me and Isaac, we have a theory that all is not well in the Obama household. Because how's she going to slip up like that? I'm like, that's right up there with Condoleezza Rice. That's my husband.
My husband, yeah.
That's right up there with that kind of slip. When I heard that, I said, oh, he better go back on a golf trip with Tiger. What's happening? Anyway, listen, let me get off of fucking Obama, but I'm just sort of, you know, I need for girls to be able to roll up and get that plan B, because that's a nice way out. Yeah, I said it. You know,
yeah, it is, and
I want to take care of it.
I want to be able to go get it, but I also want to. I want people to be out there to be able to tell them they can go get it.
They can go get it, and you know, and I can have three or four of them sitting in my medicine cabinet too. I don't know what the expiration date, but no, I'm not. You know, I have no problems with that bullshit. And any young woman in my orbit who's in trouble. Come to Sandra.
Yeah.
I'll be happy to help you out.
Go see Auntie Sandra.
No, because it's just BS, you know?
Yeah, it is. Well, it is on so many levels. You know, the judicial level here, the reason that phrase that we need, they didn't give us enough time for internal review, that's like saying how many divisions does the Pope command?
Oh, no. That's funny.
You know, because no. it's like, you know, we're going to drag our heels. No, okay, so he didn't get what would it, because it begs the question, Sandra, what would sufficient time for internal review be?
January
2017.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but we know we can't. You know, there's groups they're challenging it. They will challenge this. So. More power to them. And yeah, I don't know what organization it is, but I might have to send them $20 because this is just madness, you know.
Well, I've got a couple of reactions here. Let's see. President not sure just got on the bad side of a lot of people. Susanna Baruch from interim president and CEO of the Reproductive Health Technologies Project. She's pissed. So's Nancy Northrup, president and CEO of the Center for Reproductive Rights. Cecile Richards, president of Planned Parenthood. Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women. And Elise Hode, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. They are all, I think Barack is off of their Christmas card list.
That's a binder full of
That's a binder full of women, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, listen, somebody said something I read on the Twitter. They said a binder full of bundlers. That's what Obama does when he picks his people. He has a binder full of bundlers.
Yeah, did you happen to notice who's going to be
Prince
the new head of the FCC?
Well, what about the Pritzker, who's going to be the commerce person who boiled her workers who were going on strike? You know that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we got some evil people coming up. She's horrible. She's absolutely horrific.
Well, I mean, I was thinking, I'm focused, I pay attention to FCC stuff, but, you know, I just thought, grab your internets and hang on tight. Because this guy's a lobbyist for the cable, a former lobbyist for the cable companies and wireless companies.
I mean, he worked for both sides that isn't our side. And it's kind of like, once again, I'm not facing election. And when he's not facing election, it becomes even more corporatist, not less.
Yeah, no kidding. Well,
you know, so... that's why I was laughing when he was talking about that $100 million that Adelson could have pointed his way. I know he's making a joke, but I was like, that's telling me a lot. You know, at that dinner he had?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, that was pretty obnoxious, but the only joke he said that I have to give him credit for was you people want me to, you know, reach out and have a drink with Mitch McConnell? You have a drink with Mitch McConnell. I was rolling. That was the best line I've ever heard come out of Obama's mouth.
And that, you know, the Kentucky folks are proud of the bourbon and stuff. And that had, I got to think, that stung a little.
Oh, shit. No, I thought that was, I thought that was really well delivered, too. He was like, you have a drink with Mitch or Mitch McConnell. That was very funny on his part. But the sort of reverse blackface with the Daniel Day-Lewis stuff, that was deep. That was deep. I'm like, ooh, shit. Only a black president can come up with shit like that. I was like, wow. It was like reverse cork, man. Black cork shit. I was like, whoa. I know the listeners don't know what I'm talking about.
No. Well, then expand on it, for heaven's sakes.
No. Listen, I gotta go. But basically, it was Obama playing. It was Daniel Day-Lewis playing Obama the movie.
Yeah.
And you know that just has a bit of a reverse history of sort of blackface. In action. That's
right.
It was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it was kind of like working whiteface.
Yeah, it was just, you know, but anyway, he should, when he finished the presidency, he should fucking do the Tonight Show and call it a day. He's quite good.
Well, he is. Well, you know, when you're the president doing that, I guess theoretically you've got some of the best comedy writers in the world. Or maybe this is just the stuff they sit around, you know, waiting for the cabinet meetings to start.
Also, though, he did win that, was it an international or national award for advertising for his campaign?
True.
Which people never, I always find that really strange and, you know, Edward Bernays-like that he won that award. You know?
Yep.
And so, anyway, I don't know. You know, of course, Obama's a bit of a enigma, but it's not working too well for us progressives, though. That's
no, well, what we're finding out, Sandra, is that he is a very good campaigner. and it doesn't go much further than that.
Yeah, but it does, because it's detrimental. He keeps appointing these really scary people to really important positions, and why can't he come up with a plan to take care of his judgeship problems? I mean, that is really disturbing.
Well, and what's going to happen when we get President Jeb Bush in 2016 is that judge problem's going to go away, and they're all going to be little, you know, former Shining Path ex-Maoist, now hardcore right-wing GOP judges. And
well, you know, I was also listening to what you were saying about the, you know, I mean, the sequester stuff is really, that's some deceitful governance. I have never seen anything like this, Bob. I mean, this is government, like, preying on the citizenry. What else can you call it?
It's, well, I call it the complete failure of government. I mean, at this point, nobody expects me to be Mr. Sunshine or anything. But,
well, no, but it's,
no, this
it's
is fair. This is government. We are. If we're not already there, I don't know what it's going to take to get us there. We're a failed state.
Well, I mean, but it's a failure of governance. But at the same time, I look at this article saying that a third of the people are prepared to overthrow, and you know, have you seen 44% that?
44% of Republicans are ready to go water the tree of liberty. With some natural manure.
So, you know, I mean, and all that sort of clashes together, and it's just hideous because they've effectively come up with a line item type veto situation, and they're, next up, mark my words, Obama will be signing some bill to mitigate or eliminate these defense cuts. And all that's going to be sequestered and are the programs for the people.
Yeah, well, isn't that what the FAA thing was? Wasn't that just a test case to see if we could get them to get everybody together to fix one of the problems? And now we're going to go fix the Pentagon?
Right, that's the thing, and it's just, you know, it's a horror show unfolding for any of us who, you know, view government as a vehicle to empower and help people. It's sad to watch. I feel really kind of sick looking at it.
Well, and it's gonna get sicker if it's actually covered, Sandra, because I mean that story out of Contra Costa County. So 200 old people are going to stop getting food. I mean that's terminal, Sandra.
I mean,
200 dead people.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
that's somebody's granny.
Certain quarters said that these cuts would cause death, you know, but they're never listened to. And the people who are dying don't have any sort of lobbyists, so fuck them.
Right, feed them fish heads.
And they've atomized our culture so much that no one sees what's going on. They don't care. It's not part of their information silo or Twitter feed, I guess.
So what? Do we have to, you know, those glitzy LED screen electronic billboards, do we have to put up one of those with a live feed of Granny starving to death? I mean,
we got
hunger strikes going on at the concentration camp in Guantanamo.
Well, which is why you saw Obama pop up. He wasn't doing out the goodness. He's freaking out because it's completely.
They're gonna die on his watch.
It's out of control, and you know, I mean, Bobby. It took a few years later when Bobby Sands croaked. That shit. That was a game changer.
Yeah, and Maggie Thatcher had to wear that.
Exactly, and he died, but that really changed up a lot of stuff in the Troubles, and I don't know who's going to disagree with me on that. So, this stuff in Gitmo, you know, they, when they start dying, I mean, it's a problem. It's a problem for Obama.
Well, and how? And I guess this is more of a medical question than anything, but how long can you force-feed somebody with a nasogastric tube pumping Ensure into their bellies, And they still stay alive?
Yeah, I don't.
Does the human body have a way of shutting that thing down too?
I just think that it's torture, and it's interesting that it's kind of exploded, you know, in the media, hence him rolling out talking about it, because I guess these 100 plus people deciding not to eat is doing the job, because I don't think too many people are aware that the vast majority of those men are free to go.
Yeah.
There's no reason for them to. It was a mistake. They've been acknowledged as being
right.
There.
At this point in time, it's a concentration camp.
Right. And so I'm not buying that, oh, my hands are tied, Congress needs to step in, blah, 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 because the chain of command in the U.S. government is so effed up right now. They can do whatever they want to do.
Pretty much.
And it's sort of all of a sudden my hands are tied. Anyway, that Gitmo situation is a mess. And the only other thing I want to mention before I go is, I'm sorry, but they unlocked up this MF-er in Bangladesh, froze his assets, and people riding in the street, you know, braying for blood. Do you know who owns the company in West Texas?
Somebody who is not in chains.
Okay, but I mean, the comparisons are just crazy. It's like, wait a minute, that town was laid to waste. 11 people are dead. Who knows how many people are missing? They broke Homeland Security laws. Yet and still, we don't hear nothing about it. No one's locked up. It's like, oh well.
Yeah, isn't there something in? No, I was asking myself the very same question. Isn't there something in that would be chargeable, or do we have to wait for the grand jury to meet?
I don't know what the hell is going on, but anyway, I don't know. I just am sort of, it's just kind of awe inspiring that the same kind of industrial malfeasance can go on here. And we're supposed to just accept it, with no questions about that they can zone an effective bomb next to schools.
Well, to schools, to a nursing home, for Christ's sakes, to neighborhoods.
And that's that Ayn Randy and fantasy world where government plays no part, not even zoning. And that's Texas. And that's a place where,
and Rick Perry needs to wear that.
Well, someone need to tell me why this fucker is still governor after 20 years. I mean, I know it's not 20 years, but you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, how many years ago? Molly Ivins is the one who named him Rick Goodhair Perry.
Yeah, 13, he was governor after W. So we're on his 13th year now. And it's like, I know they only meet every 2 years, but go away. When's their election? What's happening?
Yeah, go back to that preciously named ranch of yours.
Oh, man. I mean, I feel for the people in Texas because I read there's like 140 of those plants over that state.
140.
Something crazy like that.
Well, I know the one they were really worried about wasn't that one. Now, what does that say?
Anyway.
Well, you did. You got a note in from Kevin in Colorado Springs. He said, "Tell Sandra I said much thanks to her for putting voice to the point that if your family's fucked up, there's no help." Bingo. An extraordinary amount of truth of that statement at so many different levels, from my own life to things I've witnessed personally and professionally, and it's just the plain truth. If you're low middle class to poor in this country, there's no real help. Even if you're rich, if you think about it quite frequently, there's no real help for you if you have a real problem. It's just that you and your family have a bit more money to deal with things. At any rate, Sandra put into words what I've been feeling but not yet been able to put into words myself yet.
Well, that's because when you say stuff like that in this country, you know, you're labeled some sort of whinger, or, you know, you're not tough enough, or, you know, we all have to be independent. My liberty. That's all I'm supposed to be saying.
And see, I was ruined at an early age because I heard that, you know, that classic line, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." And that seems to be becoming
sort of a mantra these days. You know, well, granny's free. Granny's free to starve.
Well, I was just, you know, I was just thinking about, you know, I went to public school in the golden era of California public education. You know, brace yourself. Driver's education was just part of the high school experience, Bob.
Yeah, well, I forget who I was told. We had in little old, you know, you went at the golden age of California education. I guess there was a golden age of Alabama education. We not only had driver's ed, Sandra, we had a thing called a driving range, and it wasn't at a golf course. It was a big asphalted area, like a parking lot, but with no light poles, and it was all marked off in lanes and parking spaces and places to parallel park.
Oh, yeah, we had the same setup, but, I mean, that is, like, unimaginable now as we pay $50 a year for some music lessons in the elementary school. So,
oh, right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You should see the roads I drive on. You know, they turn kids loose with learner's permits in so-called driver's ed out here on U.S. Route 60, two-lane highways, with coal trucks coming at them. And yeah, I guess it's just some sort of trial by combat, baptism by fire?
Yeah, no, the point I'm trying to make, though, is it wasn't, you know, there used to be, even in this country, just a bit more state support. I mean, after the Reagan revolution or dystopia, whatever you want to call it, I mean, everything just evaporated to the point where if your public organization messes up slightly, it's going to be privatized, and that's it.
Well, this is a triumph. This is a triumph of the idea that government is bad. This is the wholesale rejection. You know, once we get past the wrong things they thought, and any good ideas that the framers had, this is the rejection of all of them.
Well, which gets back to what I started out with. You have a public policy that can be executed painlessly, still being muddled. And, you know, listen, I got to go, so I'll just leave you at that and have a good evening.
Hey, you too, Sandra. It's awful good talking to you.
All right. Bye.
Sandra calling from California on the Skype line. The Skype line, as well as the regular phone lines, are both open. The Skype line, of course, is Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. And you know the regular phone numbers. There's a lot of them, but all you need to know is one number. 304-658-3333. Patty writing in says, I'm following alerts on the Guantanamo situation. It's really effed up. We did the lesser of two evils is still evil thing here, and this is only one teeny tiny piece of our effed now. I just hope the 34% of the morons remember a damned lot of us lefties have shooting guns too. You know, just saying. The article Patty sent along, headline, Guantanamo Bay hunger strike, 60 days in, the situation is growing increasingly dangerous. The author of the piece, Aubrey Bloomfield, says, I don't want these individuals to die, Obama said, but how long can the hunger strikers be expected to survive? And this kind of answers the question that I asked of Sandra a few minutes ago. According to physiologists, 60 days is considered the rule of thumb for how long someone can survive, although this varies according to the individual's body fat and striking strategy. Even fasting for 3 to 5 days is dangerous, as the body starts breaking down fat to produce energy. Breaking down fat rather than glucose, the liver then starts to produce toxic byproducts. It's all downhill after week 3, or whenever weight loss exceeds 18% of the starting weight. The body tries to compensate by slowing down its metabolism, entering a starvation mode. Still, once fat stores are entirely depleted, the body has no choice but to mine the muscles and vital organs for energy. The striker simply wastes away as his body, quite literally, consumes itself. Earlier this month, the New York Times published an op-ed by Guantanamo detainee Samir Naji Al-Hassan Mokbel entitled "Guantanamo Gitmo is Killing Me." He recounts the harrowing ordeal of his fast, which has been taking place since February 10th, and which had already caused him to lose well over 30 pounds by the time the article was published on April 14th. The situation was desperate, he said, and people are fainting with exhaustion every day. Remember, this is just subtropical Cuba. Or tropical Cuba. Out of a total of 100 hunger strikers, there are currently 4 who are hospitalized and 23 who are being force-fed. Both the International Committee of the Red Cross and the American Medical Association have denounced the force feeding because somewhere in the halls and deliberations of the civilized, there has been a determination via the World Medical Association that a fasting prisoner, quote, shall not be fed artificially, unquote. Well, stuffing an NG tube up the nose and down the gullet and pumping in Ensure is about as artificial as you can get. And yeah, Bobby Sands, to whom Sandra referred, he lasted 66 days and then died. By comparison, Gandhi, his longest fast was 21 days, at which point the entirety of the Indian people were begging him to eat. And Cesar Chavez, at one point, fasted for 36 days. See, this is a problem. And part of the problem is that we do not acknowledge Guantanamo Bay for what it is. I think, as far as broadcast is concerned, God, it was 2005, no later than 2006, when I started referring to Guantanamo Bay as a concentration camp. Not out of any political agenda, not out of any desire to make the situation sound worse than it is, but merely because that is what Guantanamo Bay is. When you have a prison population entirely of one ethnicity or one religion, who are there without any, in many cases, perhaps a majority of cases at this point in time, without being guilty of anything. See, that's why Guantanamo Bay is Guantanamo Bay. Had any of these prisoners had a foot on so-called American soil, they would have had access to the courts. Does your memory extend far enough back to remember when the Congress of the United States and the Bush administration put paid to the idea of habeas corpus? From the letter in the New York Times by Samir Naji Al-Hassan Mokbel, he said, I've been detained at Guantanamo for 11 years and 3 months. I've never been charged with any crime. I have never received a trial. I could have been home years ago. No one seriously thinks I'm a threat, but still I'm here. Years ago, the military said I was a guard for Osama bin Laden, but this was nonsense, like something out of the American movies I used to watch. They don't even seem to believe it anymore, but they don't seem to care how long I sit here either. When I was at home in Yemen in 2000, a childhood friend told me that in Afghanistan I could do better than the $50 a month I earned in a factory and support my family. I'd never really traveled and knew nothing about Afghanistan, but I gave it a try. I was wrong to trust him. There was no work. I wanted to leave, but had no money to fly home. After the American invasion of 2001, I fled to Pakistan like everyone else. The Pakistanis arrested me when I asked to see someone from the Yemeni embassy. I was then sent to Kandahar and put on the first plane to Gitmo. Last month, on March 15th, I was sick in the prison hospital and refused to be fed. A team from the ERF, the Extreme Reaction Force. Oh, Jesus, we've got about that. A squad of 8 military police officers in riot gear burst in. They tied my hands and feet to the bed. They forcibly inserted an IV into my hand. I spent 26 hours in this state, tied to the bed. During this time, I was not permitted to go to the toilet. They inserted a catheter, which was painful, degrading, and unnecessary. I was not even permitted to pray. Not that the praying would have done you any good, buddy, but no, that's still wrong. I'll never forget the first time they passed the feeding tube up my nose. I can't describe how painful it is to be force-fed this way. As it was thrust in, it made me feel like throwing up. I wanted to vomit, but I couldn't. There was agony in my chest, throat, and stomach. I had never experienced such pain before. I would not wish this cruel punishment upon anyone. Hey, John McCain, we don't torture. Everybody who thinks we don't torture, raise your hand. You too, John McCain. Oh, sorry, you can't because you were tortured. But we don't torture. See, if we really did buy into this religion malarkey that most of this country purports to believe in, we would be on our knees praying, begging whatever God it was that we believed in to please forgive us and not squash us like a goddamned bug for what we're doing. This was published in the New York Times. They read that in Saudi Arabia. Hell, they read it in Afghanistan. They read it in a lot of places where people with long memories will tell their children, and their children will tell their children, and their children will tell their children. God knows how far down the centuries until one day an opportunity for retribution it presents itself. And that retribution will be terrible, and the vengeance will be awful. And someone who had nothing to do with any of this will pay. Just as we are extracting our bloodlust upon people who had nothing to do with the events of September 11th, 2001. The writer says, during one forced feeding, the nurse pushed the tube about 18 inches into my stomach, hurting me more than usual because she was doing things so hastily. I called the interpreter to ask the doctor if the procedure was being done correctly or not. It was so painful that I begged them to stop feeding me. The nurse refused to stop feeding me. As they were finishing, some of the food spilled on my clothes. I asked them to change my clothes, but the guard refused to allow me to hold on to this last shred of my dignity. When they come to force me into the chair, if I refuse to be tied up, they call the ERF team, so I have a choice. Either I can exercise my right to protest my detention and be beaten up, or I can submit to painful force feeding. You tell me who this sounds like. You tell me if this is the conduct of a nation that believes in freedom and liberty. Bullshit. The only reason I'm still here is that President Obama refuses to send any detainees back to Yemen. This makes no sense. I am a human being, not a passport, and I deserve to be treated like one. I do not want to die here. But until President Obama and Yemen's president do something, that is what I risk every day. There is no end in sight to our imprisonment. Denying ourselves food and risking death every day is the choice we have made. I just hope that because of the pain we are suffering, the eyes of the world will once again look to Guantanamo before it is too late. Is it just me, or... if this was another country, would someone have sent a rescue mission in after these poor souls? Marty asks, remember Sicko, the movie, when some Congress critter complained on the floor of the House just how good the prisoners had it in Guantanamo? Yes, I do, Marty, I do. Randy says, when they used to do that in the Soviet Union, we called it unbelievably cruel. If you do it in the United States, it's called cruel and unusual punishment. Jesus. Now, I just saw a news alert coming from the New York Times while I was talking with Sandra, all about how apparently Chokar Tsarnaev is singing like a bird about what he and his brother's plans were. They were going to do their bombing on the 4th of July, but they decided instead to go with the Boston Marathon because they got done building their bombs earlier than they expected. Now, that's going to be a great palaver in the for-profit media. But can I ask a question? Who's telling the New York Times this stuff? Why is the information of the interrogation... Well, on the one hand, okay, great. Open, transparent, maybe. But remember, we've got actual sworn members of Congress who want that young man to be treated like the people who didn't do anything at all and stuffed into Guantanamo Bay, into our concentration camp there. Because, frankly, they want to torture him a little bit. I mean, really? Don't you think there's a nasty, nasty urge for vengeance when you hear something? Oh, I want to have him treated like an enemy combatant. I'm not saying this by any as any sort of exoneration, but is it really that hard to remember the fact that he's an American citizen? A really and for true American citizen? I know we worry about a lot of things, but that scares the bejesus out of me when I hear a John McCain or a precious Lindsey Graham cracker. Hollering about how they want an American citizen held as an enemy combatant. That really is the hand tipper. That's the big tell, isn't it? There aren't any Obama re-education camps. But by God, apparently Lindsey Graham and John McCain and their ilk would like for there to be some McCain-Graham re-education. Ah, screw educating them. We just want to torture them some. And sweet Jesus, there's going to be hell to pay. But naturally, the next time something blows up or limbs go flying, we'll be shocked. Shocked. If we can even get people to acknowledge that what happened happened. I give you... Well, I don't give you, but well, you know what I mean. Let's meet New Hampshire State Representative Sheila Tremblay. No, I'm sorry, Stella Tremblay. Stella! Stella Tremblay. Now, she says, she's been saying, remember how much fun we had the other night with Badandi, 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 Badandi. Stop that. The goober from InfoWars. Well, apparently, it's getting some traction, the idea that this is all made up. There's a guy named Pete Santilli, and he had Stella Tremblay on his radio show . Enjoy this guy's an Alex Jones wannabe.
It's no longer that, but let's go back to what has brought you into the public light and what brings you on the show today. You wrote that the Boston Marathon attack on April 15th was carried out by quote-unquote black ops. And let me read your quote here. The Boston Marathon was a black ops terrorist attack. And Ms. Tremblay wrote in a message to conservative commentator Glenn Beck, one suspect killed, the other one will be two before they even have a chance to speak. Drones and now terrorist attacks by our own government. Sad day, but a wake-up to all of us. First there was a suspect, then there wasn't. What a bunch of Keystone cops. What caused you to come out the way you did? And I've come out in similar way, but go ahead.
I cannot take credit. One of the constituents sent me an email. Says,
she can't take credit. She can't take credit. She also can't form a rational thought, but who's counting?
Have you seen this on Black Ops? And I was directed to Sergeant Major Potter, is it?
Lieutenant Colonel Potter,
yes. And when I listened to him, I saw his face. He looked like he knew what he was saying, that he had a conviction, that he was honest.
A conviction or a commitment? We're not sure here. I think butterfly nets were involved.
And he said, don't believe everything in the news. I was never aware of black ops before. I mean, I was in Venezuela and cried my heart out when I watched 9/11. And I couldn't believe this was happening, and I swallowed everything that was told me, because most Americans want free, you know. They
was that an ice cube clinking in a glass there? Just checking.
I guess you have to get off, huh?
No. Oh, no, not at all.
I know that.
Will somebody buy this goober a mic mute? No, not at all.
Most Americans want freedom. They want to live and let live.
Does that include not starving grannies to death? I just want to know, Stella. Stella Tremblay. You know what? You know what we need? Motivation. I was just over there on the Brando set, and they're just swimming in it. Stella!
And the government is there basically to make sure the protection of that freedom is there. That's all the government has to do.
Yeah. And if granny starves, F her. And if little kids don't have Head Start, F them too. And you know, if fertilizer plants rocket toward the moon and take the nursing home with it, freedom!
Then he asked, go to InfoWars. Then I went to InfoWars.
And there we have it. Stellar. It's Bob. Not everything on the internet is true. I know it may be hard to comprehend. I get the idea that tying your shoelaces is probably hard to comprehend, but no, not everything on the internet is true, and almost everything at InfoWars is not true. But do please continue.
InfoWars, and I started opening my eyes, and I thought, you know, Alex Jones, everyone says he's crazy.
Only because he is.
But perhaps there's some truth to this.
No, perhaps not.
Or I looked at it in my heart. Something told me there's something wrong here.
Something in your heart told you there's something wrong here. Well, Stellar, the here that there's something wrong at. It's your brain. I guess nobody ever told you, but you've got a broken brain. And so apparently do a number of people in New Hampshire who have elected this person to the New Hampshire state legislature not once but twice. She likes this kind of stuff, though, because if you wander around in the really, really rich and fertile ground of weirdo, right-wing, separatist, part of the internet, you'll find another thing that they really love is this constitutional amendment that never passed that says that no member of government may accept a title of nobility. And they argue that Esquire, which is a something that you hang behind a lawyer's name, is a title of nobility, and therefore that no lawyer should be allowed to be in the government. She introduced that in the State House of New Hampshire, but are we surprised?
Wow.
You just have to...
Wow, yeah, that's what I say too, Santilli.
Look at that backpack, and you can see, if there's an explosion... The backpack is blown to smithereens. There's no...
Physics? She's a physicist now? The backpack is blown to smithereens. That's a scientific term, smithereen.
Nothing left. Mm-hmm. What was it doing just laying there? Then, my first gut reaction seeing the horror of...
Oh, here comes the payoff pitch. 3-2, bottom of the ninth, bases loaded, and here's the payoff pitch. All the runners are going.
That person that had their legs blown off, you know, with the bones sticking out?
Yes.
Yes,
ma'am.
And he was...
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Is blown to smithereens. There's nothing left.
Mm-hmm.
What was it doing just laying there? Then, my first gut reaction seeing the horror of that person that had their legs blown off, you know, with the bones sticking out?
Yes, ma'am.
And he was not in shock, and I looked...
Because you can diagnose that from a photograph. See, we have a problem in the right wing in America because they like to diagnose things based on videos and photographs. Remember how they diagnosed Terry Schiavo? This is that.
And I thought... There's something, I don't know what's wrong, but it seems surreal to me. Mm-hmm. I talked to my sister, who's not into politics at all, and she said, yeah, I saw the same thing. He was not in shock. He was not in pain. If I had had those type of injuries, I'd be screaming in agony.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot money. I trust you saw. It ain't easy to look at. I trust you saw the photograph. An instant that was probably captured, oh, I don't know, probably what, in old camera terms, probably around, oh, F-20, F-22, maybe, a tenth of a second? And she can tell that this person who has just been horribly mangled and is being rushed away in a wheelchair is just fine with all of it. They're not shocked. She's saying the guy with his legs blown off wasn't real. That's where they are. Wasn't. It was all staged. Just like in the movies. I don't know. I guess the guy's face was supposed to be sort of elongated like Munch's scream, and he was supposed to have his hands to his head and going, my legs are blown off. And as I frequently note in stories like this, there are probably hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals who at some point in time walked into a voting booth and said, yeah, her, family values, loves liberty, I'm going to vote for her. That's wrong accent, but you get the idea. I like how she wants to make sure that her Alex Jones wannabe host with the clinking glass and understands the photo she's talking about. My first gut reaction seeing the horror of that person that had their lugs blown off, you know, with the bone sticking out. Now that, too, is a bit of a tell. It means that she thinks there might be other photographs of people with their legs blown off whose bones were not sticking out. And we don't know if they were reacting appropriately to the standards set forth by Stella Tremblay. Spent a lot of my time. One of the earliest lessons I remember from Mother was that never say you hate someone, because hate is a powerful and destructive emotion that does more harm to the person doing the hating than the person being hated. And I think she was right. But in the case of Stella Tremblay, it really does beg one to think seriously about making an exception. What does she need? This is almost biblical in its proportion. As a means of discrediting the Gospel of Thomas, which was not included in the canonical Gospels, the story of Thomas doubting the resurrection was inserted in the Gospels, in which Thomas says, I'll not believe he's back up and walking around unless I can see him, touch him. Yeah. And so the resurrected Jesus has him put his hands in his wounds. That was all political. Well, religious, or however you want to describe it. Like I said, they were busy trying to discredit the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas. But this is that. I guess she needs to be taken to the hospital, where undoubtedly the man is still undergoing treatment. But one wonders even then, for one of these losers, one wonders if that would be... Well, they just found somebody and stuck him in a... They found somebody with no legs and they stuck him in a hospital bed and they bandaged up his stumps. That don't prove nothing. By the way, Agnes just pointed this out to me. She said, that twit was talking about Black Ops, the game. Colonel Potter? Really? Colonel Potter? Now, see here, honeycut. And go feed my horse. Sorry, Marty. Sometimes we have to understand that they walk among us. Marty asking, do you really have to subject us to this person? And again, this isn't some one-off. There's lots of people who believe, and I use that word deliberately, believe the same crap. And when they become, if not a majority, when they become a plurality, you have what is commonly referred to as a problem. Witness, for instance, the story that Sandra to the survey data, that should be sufficient. And you know, these things come along from time to time. I remember the one where 29% of New Jerseyans surveyed weren't sure whether Barack Obama was the Antichrist. Remember that one? TPM with the story. 29% of people surveyed think that armed rebellion might soon be necessary. And that's not poll 29% of Yemenis, or 29% of Pakistanis, or 29% of Bolivians or Venezuelans. That's 29% of Americans. Roughly 1 in 3. One third. That is a frightening, indeed, and a dangerous plurality. It gets more fun, however, because the number for Republicans is 44%. I suppose it's strictly a matter of the operations of the goddess of irony that that's roughly the same number as there are Republicans in the Senate of the United States. Percent, an easy third, of Republicans surveyed think that the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre is a lie. Beyond that 32% of Republicans, well, taken altogether, 11% said, well, I don't know, I'm unsure. Next time you're in a crowd, unless you're somewhere that you're sure is really, really, really sane, look around you. Do a little mental thought experiment. Count 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. And either the ones or the twos or the threes, you know what you get to tell yourself? That's somebody who would be willing to kill me. Because rebellion, armed rebellion, might be necessary. Do please remember that on our side, we generally are still hanging on to this notion of self-government. And that we, the people, is the expression we use to describe the fact that we are not subjects, but instead citizens. And that whether it be the ones, the twos, or the threes,
they think it may be necessary to take up arms against the government. If the question had been asked by the surveyors a little bit differently, it might have provided a more meaningful or perhaps at least more interesting data set. Do you believe that in the near future it may be necessary for you to commit treason? Because that's what that is. 44% of Republicans surveyed said it may be necessary in the near future to commit treason. Hell, I doubt if the number was that high in 1859. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. And of those 44%, I would bet you, with money I don't have to bet with, but I'd bet you, because I'd win, that of that 44% of Republicans who have publicly stated, at least to a poll survey taker, that they're willing and ready at some point in the near future to commit treason against we, the people of the United States, I bet you they got lots of guns. And no, this is not the Alex Jones portion of the program, but I'll also remind you that there is an outfit out there called Oath Takers. And they have, in fact, infiltrated the military of the United States. And their oath is that they have sworn that they will never fire on an American citizen. By American citizen, they mean somebody who is shooting at us, at them. No. Just because I said that doesn't mean that there's a Buy Gold Now ad coming. I don't think gold is a hedge against anything for this kind of horror. But at what point in time do we, taking all of this together, Head Start, Meals on Wheels, a crumbling infrastructure, another pipeline burst, this one north of Arkansas in the Ozarks of Missouri, but it's the same goddamn tar sands pipeline, ...44% of the Republican Party ready to engage in treason and launch a civil war, at what point in time, what is the one thing that happens where you suddenly say, oh, hell, they're not kidding? I mean, the reason I wasn't on the air Tuesday was because I was exhausted. Ferg and I had spent the entire, I'd spent 3 days working on it, and then Tuesday we spent putting it in place. We put our feet into every hall of every floor of every house office building, and we passed out ACE Act flyers to something like in excess of 80 congressional offices. By the time we were done, my feet felt like meat balloons. But along the way, because I was trying to make this an educational experience for my son, I would say, woohoo, there's a live one, pointing to an office of, say, Paul Ryan or
Oh, my God, crazy lives there, as we walked past Marsha Blackburn's. And the thing is, you don't know how many times I said that. It got to the point that I could just kind of hook a thumb at a door, and Ferg would look at me and go, nuts? Absolutely, son. And finally, he looked at me and said, there seem to be a lot of those. I said, yes, son, I think it's risen to the level of an infestation. And if 44% of the people who vote for the likes of Marsha Blackburn, or John Boehner, or Paul Ryan, or Louie Gohmert, or Michelle Bachmann, are ready to take up arms against the rest of us, and not a damned word has been uttered against this by any single member of the Republican Party whatsoever, what does that tell you about the likelihoods of things going down the road and going down the toilet as they go down the road? Just something I suggest might be worth considering. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. Welcome back to the air.
Hey, thanks, Mark.
You sound good and strong, and hopefully you got a day's rest. I everything that I hear from everybody that calls the show, Sandra, yourself, all the same interpretations, and we don't sit around and listen to people that talk like us. So we, how can people be all different in the United States and come to the exact same interpretations and conclusions and stuff without, so that should be an indicator to other people that are listening to us that there is still some sense of, right and wrong or common sense and, something, and then have such a large group of Americans miss that connection. They are so hyped up on. I know you're not a big fan of Facebook, and nor am I, but and I have gotten a little strong on that thing. I do tell people to. I won't say it over the air, even though I could, but like any case. The comment that you made earlier, just a moment ago, about soldiers in the United States and the Oath Keepers, and of course they broke up a plot, which would have failed within moments anyway, but of a group of American soldiers not that long ago, like 2 years ago or less, at Fort Stewart. And when the plot was getting ready to be exposed, they murdered some of their own soldiers, a guy and his girlfriend, and I think they would be either like Oath Keepers or actually were. So there's some, and I think that's one of the things I think when you it's one of the things that I, when I see these Americans and they show all these stupid commercials or moments on the news, and you know, a family member's coming back at the airport or bum rushing their kid at grade school, I'm not impressed with that, because I think that's so much propaganda. But they, one thing, being at my age and having worn the uniform, if you're a United States Marine leaving a Marine Corps base, and bases are called bases because they're not permanent, and forts are called forts because of that status. If you leave a base and you're in a uniform known as your camouflage uniform, Army refers to it as the BDUs, you are not to exit your privately owned vehicle unless there's an absolute emergency. If you do have to exit your vehicle, you have to get out of the vehicle and immediately put what Marines call your cover on. Whatever your headgear is, it's referred to as your cover, whether it's a helmet or a,
right,
or, you know. So, and they have everybody so tweaked up in the Corps that, I mean, when you leave a base, it's like 5 o'clock traffic, and there's a lot of people that stay on bases, and there's a lot of that come and go. But you have no reason to do that. But what I see now as soldiers, and we've all seen this over the last, actually, 15 or 20 years now, people coming back through airports wearing camouflage uniforms. I think that's one place we could immediately stop the militarization of our civilian society.
Oh, every time I'm in an airport, Mark, I see a dozen or more.
It's inappropriate. Actually, if they want to be in uniform, and from a security aspect, they make targets out of themselves by wearing them. But I don't want to live in a nation where that becomes the actual issue, though we may already be there. Let's hope not. But that they should be wearing what U.S. Marines call the Charlie uniform, which is your dress slacks, dress shoes, and either a long sleeve shirt with a tie or your short sleeve shirt. And
you said the Army calls them BDUs. Doesn't that stand for battle dress?
Yeah, your battle dress uniform. That's
so that means that on the plane they are dressed for combat imminently.
Yeah, sure. And they wear them in civilian airports. They wear them on their own. And actually, a lot of the travel is done by civilian airlines anyway, and has been for many years. Even the Flying Tigers. We're not just associated with the agency, but they were, part of a thing in Vietnam. But if you look at the photographs back during Vietnam, soldiers were wearing what I'm referring to as Charlies, and that's where.
Under the Bush administration,
obligation to wear your ribbons. You have the opportunity to wear them, but they're considered conservative. It's not a full out. Your medals are what drapes on a dress uniform. And the ribbon is the small representative thereof. And it's out of respect to whatever society you're in, whether you're in the Chinese Army or the Russian Army or American Army, and that's how you transport yourself through. And if you look at our old movies, whether it was Burt Lancaster's, the movie in Hawaii, or even Forrest Gump. He was wearing Charlie's when he's running, or if he's out in public, he was in his dress uniform. He actually, in that movie, he dressed appropriately in the uniform. Whoever the consultants were on that, they were very very accurate. That would be one place we could start almost overnight. You can issue an order: do not leave the base. And then there's a former Special Forces guy. He's a couple years older than me. He's a Vietnam veteran. I want to say his name is Stan Goff. He's a Vietnam, and he's also a Special Forces Delta, and I think he had something to do with some anti-terrorism stuff. But he is a great web page, and he's an author, and he talks about how our police have become militarized and how our soldiers have become policified.
Mark, I think there's a lot of truth in what you're saying, and I'll take it one step further, because when you were talking about how they're encouraged to go out that way, it reminded me of something that I see a lot more of here than I do military stuff, but it is a representation of a form of militarization. Just as background, and I've mentioned it on the show, I've mentioned it on the program before. My grandfather, upon leaving the coal mines, went to the bathhouse, scrubbed all the coal filth off of him, and put on clean clothes to go home. He put on the clothes the war to work. You'd go to work, change into your work clothes, and then get out of your work clothes and go home. My grandfather would have no sooner walked off the mine site in his coal mining clothing than he would have gone home naked.
Mm-hmm.
Now, however, because we've got a culture where, for instance, women drive around in their car with a silhouette of a man crawling on his knees, and underneath it says, "My husband is my hero. My husband is a coal miner." Okay? Now, they not only come off the job site wearing their filthy-ass work clothes, they go to the grocery store in them. A friend of mine who does some DJing in bars in Beckley tells me that they will deliberately dirty themselves up before they go into the bar because it's deemed to be a turn on. And it may not seem similar to you, but it's the same kind of mindset, at least from where I'm standing looking at it.
Actually, it does seem similar to me. I thank you for pointing that out. It's kind of a it's a degradation reflection, and it's really not impressive. Neither observation is impressive. And the sad thing is, I was working down in South Florida at a nuclear power plant when 43 was in the office, and all the coal miners all over the country were starting to get killed all of a sudden. And I was walking with a guy that's been in the union with me for over 30 years. I thank you very much. John, those aren't union guys that are dying. Those are all non-union coal miners, and it's too bad that they're dead, but they're not union. So those are union guys, Mark. No, they're not, John. And he did come to me later when he saw me and said, you know, you were right. I said, they wear stickers and on the hard hats, and you also see and you're seeing on stupid Facebook, not everybody, but people bring out the fact that gas was a dollar something when the Bush was in there. But you know, I was in California working in San Onofre, and I went to the gas pump, and of course things are going to be more expensive in your big city, Chicago, your California. But diesel was $4.98, and regular unleaded was it was close to $4 a gallon, and that was in 2000. I was out there in 2005 or 6, and I'm like, what? Where are these people? And even the Marines sitting behind me on the bleachers, where thousands of Marines were being processed, being marched into a huge auditorium at Camp Lejeune, which has sway over about 20 to 30,000 Marines, whether they're coming in from Norfolk or not, or on deployments to the Med. We need to get our shots, and these Marines sitting behind me on the bleachers, and I'm talking to my buddies who are sitting next to me, and it's a cool day, it's comfortable, it's January. We're called back as citizen soldiers for Desert Storm, and I said, what'd you guys just say? And they said, yeah, you didn't know that? And I said, no, you say the Bush family owns Pennzoil. I go, you're kidding me. And they go, where are you from? And they said, well, one Marine was from, like, New Hampshire, and another one may have been from Connecticut. And I said, I never knew that. I go, you're shitting me. And I go, they go, no. So then, and of course, 15 years later, I read Kevin Phillips' book, American Dynasty, and he's been interviewed, obviously, a few times on C-SPAN, but he looked at the TV one day in one of his interviews, and he said, I helped get them elected with the Southern Strategy, which I think I've mentioned to you before on the show. But Kevin Phillips, who's, you know, in his 80s now, said that family, they scare me. I helped put them in there. He's he's an expert on our history and geography and culture. The other thing along the same lines, last night on Rachel Maddow, they had the former United States Army Fulbright Colonel and registered Republican who was the chief of staff for Colin Powell. He was confronted by a guy that's been on the news the last couple of days. He's a real fast talker, and I think he may be a former soldier. I think his last name is Mudd, M-U-D-D, if I don't have that right or wrong.
I think you're right.
And when you listen to him at a glance, you're thinking, hey, that guy's starting to make a little bit of sense, and then he loses my attention. And then, well, maybe my attention span's not. But this Wilkerson gets on, Bob, and he says, the guy that you just had on was the one that was confronting me right at the United Nations, telling me what to put some words in terrorism into Colin Powell's speech. And he goes, I said that was bullshit. I'm not going to do it. And actually, the dude dimed him out to George Tenet, who obviously went along with the plan. Wilkerson, a neat man, is really kind of like Wendell Potter has come out with the healthcare industry. The people that were actually a part of the operation saying, no, we're telling you, or Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski with the Office of Special Plans, who she steps down. Says, you know, I've done this work for over 20 years as an intelligence analyst, and they're cherry-picking information. But why the right? I have to be honest with you. I was coming back from New York. I was just working up there, Bob, a few weeks ago when a lot of this stuff that's been in the news was unfolding, and it's actually what woke me up. I was working night shift, and my phone lit up my room, and I thought I had turned it off, which I normally want to keep my phone in the off position. The light woke me up, so I picked it up, and it was the bombing in Boston. So I let that unfold, and of course I paid close attention to it. Let me Google my distance where I'm safe.
And offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Look, we know in days like yesterday and today we have a lot of work to do. We got to make sure that we work with our counterparties, our clients, to get the answers they want, and we're pursuing that as we speak. And we're also exploring other alternatives, such as strategic investments or investors and other financing alternatives. So we have work to do, and we're doing it right now.
What exactly does that mean?
What exactly does that mean? It's just a bunch of garble. And same thing with all this privatization. And again, I've yet to find anybody who's come up with a scheme that where this has benefited people like me. And maybe Rich has got an idea. I've got Rich online, too. How are you doing tonight, Rich?
Hey, pretty good. How you doing, Rich?
Oh, I can't complain. What's on your mind?
Hey, I live in Ohio, and I'm a truck driver. I drive the York PA every night.
All righty.
And you was talking about the lottery in your first hour.
Yes, sir.
Well, I always want to know why we can't propose a national lottery for, like, Medicare, Social Security, and infrastructure.
Why would we want one?
Well, it would pay for itself on the funding.
Well, the problem with the lottery is the exact problem we had here in Pennsylvania. You had the collapse in 2008, and you saw funding go through the floor. So at times when you actually need to make sure that you have secure funding, like during times of economic crisis, you're not going to have it. I see a huge problem with that. And to me, you know, the whole lottery thing depends on folks having disposable income. And that's a problem, especially now that we've seen wages being destroyed and we've seen, you know, the ability of workers to bargain for those wages being diminished. I'm curious, why would you want a lottery system for that?
Well, because of how these Republicans are, they want to just cut. And it affects my mom when they do this.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And what it should be is you and me and other folks like us getting angry at them and throwing the bums out.
Well, I've tried my part, but it's trying to get the people to understand what their policies are.
Yeah, well, and that's why we have programs like this, and which is why we need to be talking to our friends and neighbors. And look, as this stuff comes up, we got to be talking to people.
It's just some of them are so diehard Republican, it kills me.
Yeah, it blows my mind that, you know, the very people who are the ones being harmed by the policy that they're advocating are the people fighting for the policy it's just the sad reality is it is what it is, but we've got to keep fighting along.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, I've taken a pay cut for the last 20 years driving truck.
Oh, I know. You know, the sad reality, I drove a truck for years myself, and, you know, I've got my grandfather's contract from 1976 through 70, or 74 through 79 here on my desk. And in 1979, a truck driver was making $31 an hour in today's dollars with full health care, eye, dental, and a retirement package, the vacation laid out in this contract, sick days, all of that stuff, and we've allowed this to be stolen from us.
Well, you know, it was Reaganomics that started all this.
Absolutely. But it was beyond that. It was this whole neoliberal agenda, this whole push for deregulation. And it's beyond just Reagan and Republicans. It's a lot of bent-knee corporate Democrats as well. These neoliberals are just as bad.
I agree. We
need to call them out as well and hold them accountable and throw those bums out, too.
Well, I got Bill Johnson. I've called and called his office, and them people won't return my calls back.
Yeah, I've got a crazy representative myself, but I make sure I call and leave email and send messages.
Yeah, they were, calling when the right before the elections, and after the elections was over, you didn't hear from them.
Yeah, it's you know, this is where, you know, I think it's so important, especially as a truck driver, to talk to the other drivers. Because I got to be honest, when I was doing organizing, I was amazed at how many right wing truck drivers there are who think that all of the negative things that are happening to them are the fault of those liberals. Those liberals are doing all this stuff. You know, the people who brought us labor unions.
Well, you get into some nasty fights over the radio.
I've been there myself. Been there myself, Rich.
I just don't understand the people. They want to have Social Security, but yet they want to take these tax breaks. And, you know, I just can't accept taking tax breaks to have benefits.
Yeah, let me ask you about your you mentioned your grandmother a second ago and how this is going to affect her. You know, what do you see happening to her?
Well, actually, it's my mother. She's on Social Security now, but they're talking about freezing the
changing the COLA.
Yeah, the income for every year on the increase.
Yep.
And she's only getting like $651 a month. Now that's just tragic, you know.
That's infuriating, is what it is. And what you've got is they're going to freeze a couple of dollar increase that she would get every year so that we can give hundreds of thousands, if not millions, to the very top of the very wealthy people in this country who don't need it and aren't going to use it to create jobs. To me, that's something to be just absolutely furious about and take to the streets.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'd rather see us go over the cliff myself.
And I'm hoping the president holds firm on this. Because I think the Republicans lose on that. They created this mirage. They created this crisis, this hostage situation. And just as easily as they created it, they can undo it. So any pain and suffering that happens is because the Republicans in this country want it to happen.
Yeah, that's just like I shake my head that, you know, I'm from Ohio and Boehner has nobody running against you.
Yeah, well, that's in Pennsylvania, too. There are a lot of the representatives because they've drawn these districts that are so badly gerrymandered and so manipulated that nobody really has a chance. I mean, where I live, it's a 60-40 district. A Democrat, the savior himself could come down here and not get elected in that district because what we've done in politics is it's team sport. My team's going to win. Instead of talking about the policies that are going to help your mother and my grandmother and help us as working people, they don't want to do that. It's wave the flag for the team. That's what we want to talk about. But again, you know, it's the wealth class who's put us in this position, and we need to break down those barriers.
See, that's like you was talking about Walmart, and they put a distribution center in my county.
Right.
My county gave them a 10-year freeze on no taxes,
yeah,
which was ridiculous. I voted against it, but the majority wanted them to put the business there to get the economy going.
Yeah, well, I mean, we just gave $1.7 billion to a cracker plant that they were going to build in that location anywhere because, hey, the gas is here. They weren't going anywhere else. I got to take a break right here, Rich. I appreciate the call. Next time you're in town, look us up.
I'm here every night, so I listen to your show every day.
Thanks, I appreciate it. Great talking with you.
Bud.
Take a quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com. That's where you get the podcast or Stitcher on your smartphone. Back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in their new world. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions consider consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
All because the gays are getting married. That is why people die and children go unfed. When I'm sad and alone and I'm wondering just why everything about my life is feeling like it's going down a toilet bowl. If birds are known, it's cause to give.
Oh, yes, blame it on the gays. It's their fault. Everything's their fault. Nothing could possibly be the fault of the wealth class who have sucked all the investable assets out of the... Well, you know the drill. I mean, look at the Walton situation. You got four sperm lottery winners. And for those who love the lottery, and I appreciate the call earlier, Richie, I've been thinking about the idea of a lottery. And, you know, the lottery that the wealth class wins is the sperm lottery. And you look at the four sperm lottery winners, Christy Walton, Jim Walton, Rob Walton, and Alice Walton. They have a combined fortune of over $110 billion. That's the kind of winning. And understand, you know, they got it the old-fashioned way. They didn't even have to put a dollar down. They inherited it. And you look at the fact that corporate profits have never higher, corporate earnings never higher, wages never lower. In the years we've been tracking this stuff, never lower. And, you know, Rich asked the question, why not have a lottery for infrastructure, a lottery for Medicare, a lottery for Social Security? And the more I think about this, the more I'm against the idea. There could not be a more regressive way of doing it. Because understand, who would then end up funding it completely? The wealth class understands return on investment. You don't see many billionaires hitting the lottery, do you? When they do their gambling, they do their gambling on Wall Street, where they pay 15% capital gains on it. When we have a lottery win, it is the highest possible tax rate. You know, that rate that we reserve for the very, very wealthy in this country. And I look at what economist Victor Matheson said. He said, you look at lotteries. They are the worst expected return of just about any gambling you could possibly do. And he estimated that slots paid out about 95 cents on the dollar.
So if you, the more you gamble and the more you go through it, you're going to lose 5%. 95 cents, that's the kind of return you're going to get, the kind of prizes that come back. A good blackjack player could get as much about as 98 cents of the dollar back. Lotteries, in the range of 50 cents, as high as maybe 60 cents. And you look at, you know, the Bloomberg News had this sucker index. They pointed out that the poorer states, states like Georgia, had the highest rates of people spending money, poor people spending money on this lottery, because that's the retirement system. Oh, if we could just win that lottery. And it becomes the addict mentality. If I could just win that lottery, I could retire and I could be like those people. Instead of, you know, squirreling away that buck or $2 or $5 or $10 a week into Social Security or into some type of retirement program, now it's become a lottery. And to do that with our infrastructure, to do that with everything else, would allow the wealth class in this country to completely abandon us. And then they'd say, well, we gave you the lottery. You've got the lottery. Which, again, is my problem with what we've done with programs for seniors in this state. Well, the lottery funds it. Well, is that how we treat that generation? Sorry, the lottery didn't bring in enough revenue this time. You don't get to stay in the nursing home. And I go back and I look at this whole push towards privatization that the right keeps trying to shove down our throat. And it's a horrible failure of an idea. But we've got a governor who doesn't have to go through the legislature, doesn't have to get any public input. We have no say in it. He's going to impose it. Our little dictator, our czar, if you will, he's going to impose it. No hearings, no oversight, no sunshine, no daylight, none of that. Going to impose it. We're going to give that contract because he can. And I looked at it, you know, during the break. I looked up a couple of things. You know, in 2011, 2012, sales are nearly $3.5 billion. Profits of more than $1 billion. Never been higher. Record year. But Camelot, the company that's going to take, they're not guaranteeing that level. No. And understand, for the last year, we've seen profits and the lottery profits go up 10% than they were a year ago. And they're on pace to go for another record year. And you know what? It's been lowballed. So that increase that would have gone, since we've seemed to believe in funding our programs that take care of our most vulnerable through gambling off the backs of workers and especially low-wage workers, where's that money then going to go once we privatize it? Because according to the information that I've got, the bid that Camelot came up with has front-loaded the profit projections. First few years, you know, pretty good. The last 10 years guarantees only 1% growth. So what happens if we have 10% growth all those years? Who keeps that? Oh, yeah, they do. They get the money. And, oh, by the way, if those last 10 years continues, they get to continue that contract for 10 more years automatically. Again, with no input from you or me. Think about 10, 20 years, 30 years down the road. And my favorite part of this whole lottery privatization scheme, and the one that caught my attention, and the one that tells me this is why Tom Corbett is doing this. This is why the Republicans are pushing for it. Because the gaming law of 2004 that was pushed through during the Rendell years, the casinos that we have, they can't make, by rule of law, they can't make political contributions. This has none of that. Camelot and the people that are the benefactors of our lottery winnings and our lottery profits, they'll be able to make extraordinarily generous campaign contributions to the people who delivered them these wild profits. Now, I'm not trying to sound conspiratorial, because we've seen these kind of movies in the past. We've seen these games in the past. And we know. We know the ending. The ending is, sorry, Granny, profits before you. Sorry, that nursing home that used to have a nurse for every 5 or 10 people, now we need a nurse for every 20. And their wages are going to be suppressed, so you're going to have a constant turnover of people doing that job. And we're going to outsource it and privatize it, do all these things to lower the wages and lower the quality of the work and lower the regulations so that, well, we're no longer caring for people in these senior centers and in these nursing homes. We're warehousing them, holding them for their final days, because you know what? Profit was so important. I'm telling you, we need to be outraged about this. We need to be calling our representatives. We need to be losing our minds over this kind of stuff. Because we're getting ripped off. Again. Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Right back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence. Your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. It is the holiday season, after all, and what we've seen is Freddie and Fannie have decided that anyone in the eviction process, well, we're going to hold off. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac said they will not proceed with foreclosure evictions during the holiday season, starting on December 17th and December 19th, and extending through January 2nd. Nobody's going to be kicked out of their homes. Who are facing evicted. Now, on the 3rd, you better watch out, because we're coming for you. But during the holiday season, we're going to make sure that they don't do it. In fact, Bank of America announced that they will also halt foreclosures just during the holiday season. Trust me, though, they will be back, because they don't want to look like the Grinch, because there's a war on Christmas? If you watch Fox News, all you see is, well, the war on Christmas! Those evil people, they don't like religion! And the real war on Christmas, if you really need to know, is not this feigned outrage over people wanting to put up a happy solstice day or Hanukkah symbols or who knows what. It's really global warming. You look at the climate change that's going on, and right now we are in at least a good portion of the country. Right now, 63% of the continental U.S. is experiencing drought conditions. The drought will last probably through the rest of the winter, especially in the Midwest. And, you know, you want to talk about the Grinch, you want to talk about the war on Christmas, well, the drought has hurt the new growth, these newly planted trees, which take 6 to 12 years to reach full height. So maybe we'll just have miniature Christmas trees from now on. In fact, the Minnesota Star Tribune writes, the dry late summer and fall killed many young trees, perhaps 40%. So, you know, the trees that we get this year, don't worry about. Those are usually 6, 10, 12 years old. Wait a couple of years when there are none, and we have to then pay double. And the reality is, a study after study has shown that we're gonna see more of these severe droughts. We're gonna see more of them more often. And the reality is, it's the climate change. And while we may be seeing the worst drought in 50 years, the impact just isn't Christmas, just isn't the Christmas trees. We've got food banks who are struggling because, well, there's not as much coming in. Donations down. So when the conservatives tell you, well, it's the war on Christmas, well, we know the real Grinch. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you get the podcast, Stitcher. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. Sunday was Workers Memorial Day, an annual day intended to reflect on preventable deaths and injuries due to a failure to implement suitable workplace safeguards. While the day is